Welcome to Real World Theology, episode 64. On this episode of the podcast, we are talking about Jurassic World. Helping me talk about Jurassic World is Laura Fissel and Mark Wingerter, people that you're probably very familiar with by this point. Jurassic World is obviously a huge hit. It is currently sitting at the number one place all time for highest opening weekend box office gross. So we're assuming that a lot of you have seen this movie. It is a continuation from the Jurassic Park line of films. Jurassic Park being a film that is more or less universally loved by everyone. And some of the sequels are not as great. But, like I said, people are seeing Jurassic World. People are enjoying Jurassic World. But the question lingers, is it all flash and no bang? And even if it is all flash and no bang, does it still have what it takes to get conversation started, even if the movie does not? So, we obviously take that on. We talk for quite a while, so the answer to that is probably self-evident, because there are conversations about consumerism, self-centeredness, enlightenment, and honestly, what takes up a lot of time is what's left when there's no character development in a film. So, here it is. Episode 64, Jurassic World and Human Greed. Movie theaters are modern day pulpits. Real World Theology exists to shed a light on the narratives that are shaping our culture, and to encourage viewers to recognize that entertainment is not mindless.
Gosh, guys, it's like you weren't even there.
Oh, whatever, blah, 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 technical mumbo jumbo. Science, let's go.
Science. Science? Can we really say science when we're talking about Jurassic World?
Hey,
that's what they do. Did you see the thing that JR linked about, like, five major things they got wrong scientifically?
No.
Oh, no. I didn't see that. Actually, the thing is that I never... Well, let me back up. The thing that I always do to categorize all the stuff on the site so you can hopefully search it and find things that you want to do is I go to IMDb... And I see how they classify the movie. And I usually use all the tags they do. Because if you're searching, you know, I want the search results to be fairly similar.
Okay.
So, I keep forgetting that, like, movies like this technically count as sci-fi.
What? Really?
They do. I mean, they're science fiction. We can't create dinosaurs.
Okay.
Yeah, that's definitely sci-fi.
They're using science.
Science.
In a fictitious way.
Okay.
But see, but that's kind of what I said. I was like, well, sci-fi. I was like,
it's a thing, because like a movie like, I keep bringing this up because I don't know, it keeps coming to my mind, but Transformers is like science fantasy because that's not scientifically possible.
Gotcha.
Well,
it's outside.
You don't think it is.
Okay, Michael Bay. It's outside of the realm of scientific knowledge for it to be feasible,
okay.
Theoretically. Like a metallic being that talks to you with a lot of medical, you know, metal, mm-hmm. Whatever.
Gotcha.
Turns itself into, you know, mm-hmm. A truck. Is not scientifically feasible, so that would technically be science fantasy.
I feel like that's a really fine line, though, because we've never seen aliens. We never, you know, we don't know if we ever will.
Right. And a lot of things are a mixture of science fiction and fantasy.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, you know, an alien is generally a humanoid alien. Except for, like, the movie Alien, they're not humanoid. But, like, most,
still,
like...
Actually, they're still kind of...
Yeah, they're humanoid-ish. I mean, they've got, like, you know,
mouth,
a head.
Teeth.
They've got, you know, a humanoid, you could lump them into humanoid, mm-hmm. because mm-hmm. they got a head, arms, legs. That's mm-hmm. humanoid figure. Humanoid is obviously a science fiction term.
Mm-hmm.
Is it?
Yeah, I think so.
You think so?
I mean, it might be a science term. Because
I kind of want to look it up.
I'm
now.
Not a scientist.
Or you keep talking about how awesome that is.
Well, it's like all the Star Trek, you know, The Next Generation and old Star Trek and, well, pretty much every Star Trek show, most of the aliens are humanoid.
Right.
Right? They look like humans. Right?
Because they just had to slap some makeup
on.
Yeah,
I mean, that's what the budget was.
Yeah,
like,
yeah, but, see, but see, what, at what point does Star Trek go from science fiction to science fantasy? Because...
Well, I mean, like the, you know, amorphous blob that killed Tasha Yar. You know, that black...
Whoa, spoilers!
From 1988. Or whatever. Yeah. 30-some... Are we almost 40 years to that one? Or 30 years of that one? Is that too close? 30-some years?
20-some years?
We're closing
88,
in on,
so yeah,
we're closing right, in 20, on we're closing in on 30, yeah,
because
we're all old.
Yeah. 27, yeah. Anyway,
so check this out.
Yeah, they blend science fiction and fantasy.
What was the end of that point? The blob is considered
fantasy. I mean, fantasy. It's not. Okay, there's gotcha. No like real science unless you think he's like some kind of tar. I mean, it's like I don't know. They sort of provide an explanation for it, surrounded by science. So. That's okay, that's part of that gray line of the fantasy and fiction.
Well, okay, yeah, okay.
But like, you know,
I don't want to. I guess
Gandalf and his magic is fantasy, right? Gotcha. That's science fantasy because it's not really, you know.
Mm-hmm. Well, I would say that they try to explain the Transformers, but I really don't want to fight about the Transformers. You know, it's like fighting with like an ex-girlfriend or something. It's just, you're like, it's just not worth it. It's just
right.
not worth
it's
it.
Like it's like the Tesseract in Avengers that has no like. Scientific basis. It's just a powerful weapon, or like the gems, the Infinity Stones. You know,
they're
super powerful.
But that's what they do in magic. That's what they do in Avengers 2, because Joss Whedon's trying to science everything, right?
Yeah,
he's like, actually, it's like a supercomputer. We just don't understand it. So
right, it's like a supercomputer, but we don't understand it. And I think the don't understand it part is like we have no scientific base knowledge for it.
Right.
All right. Well, a humanoid.
Oh. Okay.
From English, human, and oid, which means resembling, is something that has an appearance resembling a human being. The term appears in the translation of a science fiction novel from 1867 about fossils whose morphology is similar to, but not identical to, that of the human skeleton.
What is this voice? What is the novel?
Interesting.
It actually doesn't say what the novel is.
It's basically based on a human skeleton, like form.
Yeah, it has the general form. That's what I'm saying. Like, aliens kind of have the. I mean, well, not skeleton, because they have something like an exoskeleton.
Mm.
No. Thinking too much about aliens now.
Right, right.
Point being, that's a very interesting difference. And Jurassic World is a sci-fi.
Okay.
I guess movie.
Okay.
Okay.
But I never thought about that.
I'm not going to dispute that. That's an obvious fact, but I was like. Sort of kidding, not kidding about the like laughing about it. Scientific,
yeah.
Science fiction.
But, yeah,
but that's the thing. I feel like
it kind of goes into fantasy. It's so wrong.
Yeah, I feel like everyone is not that far off with thinking that mosquitoes are just like we're one step away from creating dinosaurs from mosquitoes. So, even though that's, I think they had a whole bunch of articles about that when Jurassic Park first came out, and I was like, nope.
Yeah.
For various reasons.
No, actually, wasn't it just recently that scientists, I mean, it was a couple years ago, but, like, scientists came out and said, it's, like, they actually tried to test fine DNA, and they, like, the way that DNA breaks down. You're pushing the mic towards me. I'm just going to point this out, because this is on the podcast. You're pushing the mic towards me, and I feel like I'm projecting pretty well.
No, you're kind of trailing.
I'm trailing on.
But see, don't overcorrect now.
It's like a passive-aggressive.
The DNA... what was that point I was making? Oh, yeah, the DNA breaks down.
Over time.
It cannot last that long.
Right. That's what this little video thing was saying. Okay, I'm going to try to remember the facts. I think they said that they determined that it could last, like, 1.5 million years, but most of the dinosaurs they feature are, like, 65 million years old.
Well, but then we shouldn't have a problem at all, because the Earth's only, like, 6,000 years old, right?
Yeah.
Am I right?
Am I right?
Oh, differing views about creation.
Yes.
I think my favorite one, though, is that they compared, like, the length of a great white shark to, like, the actual length of a mesosaur.
Mesosaur, yeah.
And it was,
the
like, ridiculous.
Is, like,
yeah.
Only, like, was it, like, 17 feet long or something they said?
No, it had to be longer than that. Yeah, it looks like a crocodile.
Yeah, I think it was longer than that, but the difference was not that...
maybe it's, like, 65 feet long.
Yeah.
Not 400 feet long, whatever.
Exactly. Yeah.
There's a storm brewing.
There is a storm brewing, and I'm trying to get...
This is live.
I'm trying to get these DNA things out of here.
I Anyway, and then at the end of the video, they just scroll down all the, I don't know, like all the species names that weren't right or something.
A mesosaurus lived in freshwater lakes and ponds, elongated and slim. It measured about 1 meter. So it's like three and a half foot long.
It's not very long.
Bit of a discrepancy there.
You gotta think like 17 feet is like a boat, you know. Like a,
well, I mean, 17 feet is that alligator we saw in Wilmington.
Oh, crap.
Not quite 17. He's very close. But he was a big sucker.
Yeah, that was big. But, you know, not as big as a great white shark, even. Right?
Yeah, great white sharks are about that. Yeah. That size, right?
I think you would,
Clearly, we're science experts.
I know. Yeah. We're just bringing up a bunch of facts experts. That we don't know.
From my time in biologies, I remember.
I did it twice facts. And I don't remember anything about biology. I found the thing, and it says that the great white shark is estimated at 20 feet.
And is that like the great white, the biggest ones, or just like sharks?
I think the biggest one.
I don't really see what's so great about them.
And this says that that mosasauruses grew to about 60 feet. So, you know, that's definitely not what was pictured
feet.
In the
like a whale is like 60 feet, but not like you know, like a small whale, you know.
Which
like
kind? Not a small whale. No, but a big whale.
A big whale, you know, like the big like not like a, not Moby Dick, but you know, like
a blue whale.
But the mosasaurus in the movie is like what, 500 feet? I mean, he's like enormous.
So you have to like 300 feet is the length of a football field,
right?
I mean, roughly.
Right. I'm saying like you know he's more than that.
He's not
right.
He's not the length of a football field. I don't think so. This really isn't that important.
Point it's being, hard to get a good you know.
Point being, we round
depth
the,
perception.
We come around CGI. And realize that. Maybe this should not have been science fiction. Maybe it should have been science fantasy based on some of the erroneous things. But in general, it's interesting to think of this as anything but, I thought, adventure, you know, action, thriller, maybe. Yeah. I just didn't think sci-fi for some reason. Mm-hmm. I feel like sci-fi, especially recently, it has to be, like, in space. Actually, even when, Snowpiercer was sci-fi.
Mm-hmm.
And for some reason, I was like, dystopian, I get it. But, you know, and we said dystopian sci-fi, but it was like, it's like...
There's like nothing sci-fi about, you know, like, when you think sci-fi.
Yeah, well, I mean, like...
Well, except for the train that can run, like...
Yeah, but it's just a train, you know, it's just a dystopia. You don't think dystopia and think sci-fi, really.
But, well, because I think dystopia is a smaller genre. It's like a sub-genre, but, like, fantasy and sci-fi are, like, larger categories.
Yes, that's how it is, yeah, for sure. But you don't think, when you think sci-fi, you think space.
Yes, yeah.
The final frontier.
Yeah.
Yeah. I do think space, aliens, that kind of stuff.
Spaceships, lasers, you know. But science fiction is all kinds of things. It's a mini subgenre thing, you know. Because Mad Max.
Sci-fi. Is that sci-fi?
It kind of is.
Yeah. Because you think a dystopian world, it's like a world that doesn't really exist. And is like, because of all these things that happen, the world is a dystopian place now. Some natural disaster that they don't name or something. Yeah. It's science fiction.
That, I think, actually... So I didn't really even know about the genre until I started reading Margaret Atwood. But she... Everybody qualifies her books as science fiction, but she says it's not science fiction. She calls it speculative fiction. And that, I think, is a great...
Probably more apt term for...
Much more accurate, just, you know, and I think Mad Max would definitely qualify as that. That it's like, it's taking a trajectory that you, and it's basically just looking in the future and saying this is possible from where we're standing now.
Right. Well, but see, that's the thing. I feel, unless you throw science fantasy out the window, then almost all science fiction could be speculative fiction to some degree.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like Jurassic Park could be speculative fiction. If we find a way to really master genetics.
Yeah, I guess so. I guess the distinction is that it's something that exists now. That,
right.
You know, if it was kept developing at its same pace, whether it's a cultural theme or a technology.
Hmm.
But But you're right. It probably could be.
It's a very tiny word or two word thing.
Well, yeah. could you
a hyphenated word? But it describes so many things.
Yeah. Could it be one of these things where you can just use multiple titles, and you don't have to be like right or wrong. We can kind of have like a yeah, okay.
It's like pick a band. Describe that band. Okay. Are they just a rock band? What is rock? How do you define rock? What kind of rock are they?
Do they also roll?
Yeah.
You know?
Exactly.
Anyway. Well, this particular sci-fi, I like doing quote marks on podcasts because no one can see them. Yeah. So then I have to mention them. And then I slow down the entire podcast. Mm-hmm. Anyway, this particular sci-fi action-adventure film, it was really weird to me because it's directed by Colin...
Trevorrow.
We're going to say Trevorrow.
Yes, because it's basically saying tomorrow, but you take out the O-M.
That's exactly what...
R-E-V.
That's exactly what I thought when I typed it.
Yeah.
So
great minds, boys.
I thought I heard someone like in an interview called, say, like, Trevorrow.
Yeah. Sure, whatever.
We're going to say Trevorrow. But the weird thing with me is this is a huge franchise. I mean, they've had lots of movies. Not all of them are great. I don't think anyone would say all the Jurassic Park movies are great. But... he really only had one movie under his belt, Safety Not Guaranteed. And I saw Safety Not Guaranteed. I mean, I guess Laura and I both watched Safety Not Guaranteed. And
it didn't make that much of an impression on me.
Yeah, we're like, oh, well, that's pretty good. But I mean, like, I have already forgotten everything about it. But apparently something about it said, you know what? We're going to hand you this franchise and just be cool with that.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was kind of surprising. But then it didn't hurt that... star of the moment, who hopefully will continue to be a star for a while, Chris Pratt signed on.
Yeah.
And then they got Bryce Dallas, I'm not Jessica Chastain Howard, signed on. If you actually haven't seen the music video that someone did about her not being Jessica Chastain, I suggest you YouTube it. It's pretty funny. I think it's I'm not Jessica Chastain. It's okay. Pretty good. And I
never really made the connection until you said it.
I assumed it was Jessica Chastain in this movie until I saw that because I hadn't really paid attention. I mean, because mostly I was just like, hey, Chris Pratt's in this.
Yeah.
So
I like her a lot. She's a good actress. She just picks some bad movies to be in.
Well,
generic roles.
Well, after Chris Pratt, I feel like there's not a whole lot of star power in this movie. There's like some, there's some gems like, Vincent D'Onofrio.
Yeah.
Who we now love because of Daredevil.
Yeah.
I honestly can't think of anything else he's in. Is he like in things?
He was in Men in Black.
Really?
Yeah, he was the guy in Full Metal Jacket.
The first Men in Black.
You didn't see Full Metal Jacket with us?
Mm-mm.
Oh, we gotta fix that. Oh,
okay, so
get y'all depressed.
True sci-fi, Men in Black. He was the bug.
Science fantasy.
The first bad guy.
Okay.
Cockroach.
Okay.
Yeah.
Science fantasy. Huh.
Yeah.
Science fantasy.
Let's not go down that road.
He's a humanoid alien. He's also a giant cockroach. So
exactly. Science fantasy.
Okay. I will allow you to have your incorrect definition.
Does your cockroach have to turn into a truck before it's fantasy?
Yeah.
Okay. Fair enough. Anyway, so there's a whole bunch of other people in this movie. Nick Robinson, Ty Simpkins. Jake Johnson, basically playing the same character he usually does in most movies.
Yeah. Pretty much everything.
Which actually works pretty well.
Yeah.
But, so we're all fans of Jurassic Park. I mean, I've yet to find many people who are like, I don't really care for Jurassic Park.
Yeah, actually, I don't think I realized how much I...
Find that person so I don't have to talk to them about movies.
So I can shut them out of my life.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. Just the last couple of years, was it last year that I was like, I really want to watch Jurassic Park right now, and you acquired it for me?
What? You mean we borrowed it from a friend?
Yeah, you acquired it for me.
Yeah. Jurassic Park, how do you not like Jurassic Park? Anybody?
I don't know.
How do you?
If you're listening out there,
and you're like, yeah, it's all right.
Yeah,
yeah, it's okay.
I mean, it's Jurassic Park. I mean, come on, you know. It's Jurassic Park.
I was hoping that would happen at least once tonight.
It's John Williams is what it is, yeah.
Okay, well, so we've also, I'm guessing, all been fairly disappointed with the other two offerings after Jurassic Park.
I don't mind the second one because I like the Doctor's character. I didn't mind it so much. I mean, it's not like something I want to watch over and over again. But
the first, we'll say first half of Lost World is a very good movie.
Is that the second one?
Yeah.
Yes. Okay. When the T-Rex gets to the city, it all falls apart.
It's horrible.
Yeah.
It goes from like being a really good, like this is a well-paced, well-made, well-directed Steven Spielberg movie to what?
Yeah.
And the foreshadowing of Indiana Jones and the Crystal Skull, like that bad.
Actually, the trailer scene is pretty terrifying, I think.
Oh, yeah, where the trailer's falling off. The RV or whatever. Yeah, it's great until, like, sort of right past that point when Engine starts coming in. Like, even the intros of everybody is really good.
Yeah.
I saw the third one in the theater, and I enjoyed it. It's not a good movie. It really is just like it's a weak offering, but it's entertaining as all get out, because I watched it on TV a few weeks ago and I was like, this is entertaining for like the 2000s, you know, the early 2000s.
I thought there were like flying dinosaurs in it.
There was the pterodactyl was like the big bad reveal. Monster of it, yeah. Or the big reveal. Okay. The Spinosaurus or whatever you want to say, that was like the big baddie. And there was like not really any, I don't think there was any T-Rex action.
Had the little tiny dinosaurs? Everyone was like, oh, you're cute.
That was the second one.
Okay.
Yeah.
And see, the second one...
I don't remember anything about
that. The Lost World was also a Michael Crichton book. So they had a lot of like really good story to go on. The third one is just completely made up like this one is.
Yeah.
So it really doesn't... The third one is not a Jurassic Park movie to me. It's just a scary dinosaur thriller that has Sam Neill's original character in it.
So that was the thing. Like, I actually thought the second one was so bad when I was watching it, I did not believe that Steven Spielberg had anything to do with it. Like, when his name popped up at the end of that movie, I was like...
Yeah, but you didn't direct it. I mean, it's like, you know, that's like that executive producer credit that, like, is kind of this overarching, like, do they actually have anything to do with it, or is their name slapped on it?
Yeah.
Because you put executive producer on there. I said executive director, man, executive producer. But, like, you put that on there, and it doesn't really mean anything. It can mean whatever you want it to. And Steven Spielberg is known for having a hand pretty steadily throughout.
Steven Spielberg did direct The Lost World.
Wow.
No, he did direct The Lost World. Yeah. I'm talking about Jurassic Park 3.
Mm-hmm. Oh, no, I'm talking about 2.
Are you talking about 2?
Yeah, I thought 2 was bad.
If you know Spielberg, you know, you can feel the setup of the film is very Steven Spielberg. Like, the whole beginning of the movie is really beautifully done. It's a great first half of a movie. It's just the end is just all kinds of Hollywood, like, a whole bunch of producers said, wouldn't it be cool if this happened? You know? And a lot of that, I mean, it's been so long. I think a lot of that is in the book from The Lost World, but it's just done very differently in the book and stuff. I never read the book, but I never read about it.
Well, then let me get us into Jurassic World by asking this more directly.
Okay.
What were your expectations for Jurassic World going in? And I guess, did you like it? I mean, what was your impression when you left? Like, were you disappointed? Did it meet your expectations?
Ladies first?
I felt like there was kind of a movie going on within the movie that I did enjoy. And that was the one that was very self-aware. That's the one where, like, Jake Johnson goes in for the romantic kiss and it's like, I have a boyfriend. Like, those kinds of things that happened, I thought were entertaining. Mm-hmm.
What did you expect?
Yeah, what did you really expect?
I didn't really expect much from it because, honestly, I thought the trailers were awful. And anytime Chris Pratt had a line, I was like, he's going to be awful in this film. Because his script just sounded like, I don't know, like exposition. Just a bunch of sentences of explain what's going on. It's a highly intelligent animal. Hey, I don't know.
Hey, I'm Chris Pratt.
It just sounded really dumb. So actually, my expectations were so low that I actually thought Chris Pratt was great in this movie. Mm-hmm. And, I liked his character. I liked his character a lot, but yeah, I mean, I think that it exceeded my expectations, but I didn't have to do much to do that.
Yeah. All right. That's fair.
I feel like I got exactly what I went in for. I mean, really. I mean, you watch the previews and you see all those lines and you see all that stuff and you're like, okay, so it's gonna be a not so great movie overall, but it'll be really entertaining because it's like there's just it's all spectacle in the trailer and like that's what draws you in. And so, you know, and you know Chris Pratt's great and he's great in the movie. He delivered and he delivered more than you know what I expected because he wasn't given a whole lot to work with.
That's true.
He was like, I'm the manly cliche of all manly cliches, and you know. You know, it's you're like, yeah, the movie within the movie. I think there's about six movies in this movie.
Yeah.
I mean, there really are. I mean, there's multiple movies. There's the, like, bioweapon engineered kind of thing. There's the heroic Indiana Jones tryout for Chris Pratt. There's the
commercialism.
Yeah, there's the commercialism commentary. Yeah. Then there's the, like, Transformers-esque kind of dino battles, you know? I mean, really, which are much better than Transformers battles, and they're done very, very well. You know, and I read all the interviews with Colin Trevorrow, and, you know, he was like, I want people to feel like a kid again. And so you knew going in that he was going to go for thrills and exhilaration and really play within the world that it was. He just happened to forget that you also have to build characters and stuff like that. I mean, I, you know, I think if you're reading the critiques on this movie, everybody's kind of saying the same thing. It's pretty obvious.
Well, I like...
but make no mistake, I thought the dinosaur stuff was is fantastic.
Yeah.
The best stuff since the first one.
Yeah. Well, I really like... Or we had the privilege of having JR do a guest post, and he did the review for Jurassic World for Real World Theology. And one of my favorite lines from it was very, very honest. It basically just admitted, kind of tongue-in-cheek, that we didn't come to plop down our hard-earned money for plot.
Yeah.
You know, we came for more teeth.
Yeah.
Which is like the tagline of the movie, which is basically what we got.
Right.
Didn't get a lot of plot.
Yeah.
I was like, oh, I can see a lot of these things from the first movie, you know. Didn't follow the depth to give lots of those actions that we saw in the first movie, those allusions to the first movie, as much depth that they had, but it sure was entertaining. But with that, and some of the things that you guys have already mentioned, I would ask this, that, like, did you feel like the movie was almost poking fun of its very existence?
I feel like it wanted to, and it didn't successfully do that.
It wasn't consistent enough.
You can't poke fun at giving more teeth to people, and people kind of like, that kind of like, you should be fine with what you get, kind of like commentary of like, oh, you just want more teeth. And then actually give people more teeth.
Yeah.
Like, it just doesn't work. Like, I appreciate the effort, and I like the commentary. I mean, it's there, but it's kind of inherently there in every Jurassic Park movie. But it didn't work, you know, to, like, we're going to give you this, like, huge, like, you know, spectacle of, like, a helicopter dropping into a giant nest of pterodactyls and blowing up, and then this Indominus Rex thing coming out, you know, like, that's more teeth than we've ever seen in a Jurassic Park movie. So don't, you know, it doesn't come off as this, and they certainly didn't want it to be this, but it's almost like you're making fun of the audience that you're trying to get the money from.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
But it doesn't come off so snub-nosed as that. They have an honest effort for that commentary.
It just waters down their message to... To say, like, look at all these people who are looking at their phones instead of watching this, you know, T-Rex eat this goat. You know, just... They had a lot of things going on in this film that were a commentary on how people are just disinterested in the wonder of the world now.
Snippets of it are awesome. I loved that, you know, this big spectacle from the first movie of the T-Rex eating the goat was turned into this, like, whatever kind of thing.
There are great things like that, but then, the potency is lost when they basically say, like, we know this is what you want, and, well, it's also why you're here, so here you go.
Exactly.
Well, so that to me makes the movie at least self-aware on some level. And I would say that it does kind of poke fun at the very fact that it exists at all. Because Slash Film had a really great article that we'll link in the show notes about how Jurassic World was actually about how Jurassic World got made. And they interview Trevorrow, and he says, like, the Indominus was meant to embody our worst tendencies. We're surrounded by wonder, and yet we want more. And we want it bigger, faster, louder, better. And in the world of the movie, the animal is designed based on a series of corporate focus groups. Mm-hmm. Like, in the same way a lot of movies are.
Yeah.
And when he says this, he's acknowledging what we already see Jurassic World acknowledging. Now, I think this is one of the things that we will probably... we'll keep talking about how there's this idea in this movie that they kind of hit on, and they maybe, like, hit on it again a little bit later, but they never stick with it long enough to really flesh it out.
Yeah.
Because they're talking about more teeth. Everything is bigger. And it reminds me of that Louis C.K. bit where he says, like, everything's amazing and nobody's happy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, we can look at the internet from a plane flying across the country.
Yeah.
You know, and we're depressed.
Yeah.
Because the internet's not fast enough or whatever. Like, we have dinosaurs.
Mm-hmm.
And what it honestly reminded me of was the fact that, I would say everyone's guilty of this to some level. And I can tell how I was guilty of it. Thinking back about how I don't really ever enjoy going to the zoo. I was like, been to the zoo, seen the animals, they're there,
mm-hmm.
interesting.
Mm-hmm.
But then when we got to see, when we got to drive around in South Africa and we got to see, like, lions up close with no, like, fence in between us,
uh-huh.
I was like, what?
Yeah.
Like, these guys are huge. This is crazy. I don't need to be on my cell phone or taking pictures of my camera.
Yeah.
I need to be driving fast in the opposite direction. Or, like, you know, when you can have elephants and giraffes, like, walk, like, real close to you. Mm-hmm. It you know, it was like that scene when the older brother kind of finally looked up and was like, whoa, dinosaurs.
Mm-hmm.
And that whole concept of not being able to live in the moment, being on your phone the whole time, needing something bigger and splashier. Splashier, maybe? We'll go with splashier. Mm-hmm. Bigger, splashier, whatever.
Sure, it fits, whatever.
Like I said, it... Are we anesthetizing ourselves to... Not like necessarily violence, but explosion. Like, everything's got to be bigger. Like, we will never put our phones down unless something
right.
Is that crazy? Is our audience is really getting this way?
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, I think I say yeah, not to answer your question, but like, there's so much to that.
Yeah.
There's so much to dig in with that.
Go
with
ahead.
That argument, and it's hard to kind of figure out where to start. But, you know, first of all, I mean, Jurassic World doing that, there's not enough, they don't give you enough about the world, and maybe they don't have to because it's a dinosaur movie. They don't give you enough about, honestly, they don't give you enough about the world in the movie, in the film, to really drive home the message of, like, are we, would you and I, and if Jurassic World actually existed, and say it had existed for 5 years,
mm-hmm.
and we'd been to it once. Would you not be, like, clamoring to go back? I mean, this is also something, like, you have to fly to, you know, mm-hmm. and it's, like, an island far off. It costs a lot of money to go see these dinosaurs.
It's like Disneyland, but
people,
better.
Yeah, but I mean, like, you know, Disneyland is an attraction, you know, like they say in the first movie, the Pirates of the Caribbean breaks down, the pirates don't eat the tourists, you know.
Mm-hmm.
but Pirates of the Caribbean are, you know, they're animatronic. These are actual dinosaurs. Would we really... Would we really look at a T-Rex and think of it as like an elephant? And how you know, because the movie doesn't give you that kind of, it doesn't drive home that like people would just be looking at their cell phones and not a Tyrannosaurus Rex in real life.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you would have to, I think you'd have to have 30 years or maybe 20 years of just to have this idea kind of malaise over to be like, we need to build something with more teeth that's going to scare mm-hmm. the adults, mm-hmm. you know.
I didn't even really pick up that the park was in danger of losing funding.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
Right.
I see what you're saying.
Because they got all these fancy stores, and there's there's tourists everywhere, and it's like, they haven't even shown the Indominus Rex yet to the public. They're just finishing building the compound and debuting this idea.
Right.
So, like, is it really waxing and waning that much? I say all that to say they're taking a very overarching, broad stroke view of humanity with it, to say that we would be so disinterested that they would have to clamor for new ideas to come up with that.
Right.
I mean, what they say they put into the Indominus Rex, like $26 million into that one animal. I mean, which makes a lot of sense, but again, are they really losing that much? Are people really not going to Jurassic World? I would be like,
but how much
freaking
out? I was like, can you just like bump ticket prices like $5 a ticket? I mean, like,
yeah, boom. Like, yeah. I mean, it's like, you know, make it like the NFL, you know, just charge more for popcorn or whatever, you know. So it's like, I had a hard time kind of, I really appreciate the commentary, but the commentary is inherent in a Jurassic Park movie anyway. That, you know, the message of every Jurassic Park movie is we think we're gods, and once we start messing with nature, nature messes back. And so, you know, this whole broad stroke view of, like, we're so disinterested that we're looking at our phones instead of the TV screen. How much money did Jurassic World make opening weekend? Like $200 and some million in the U.S. broke the opening weekend for, you know, international sales and all that stuff. I mean, it's you're picking on, you know, you're preaching to the choir. You know, you're picking on your choir, you know, basically. And so it's a very weird broad stroke thing that they make. But I think of it like this. You look at how good the very first movie was, right? And I remember I was 8 years old sitting in the theater for Jurassic Park.
Wetting your pants.
I mean, almost. I mean, yeah. Literally the most vivid moment I have from being a kid and you know, discovering movies was after that raptor scene where that guy got, you know, pulled into the thing at the very beginning, my mom looking over at me and going, "Are you okay?" And I was like, "Are you kidding?" Seriously, I was like, "Yeah, I'm fine. This is awesome." You know, and so there was a huge amount of wonder. And so that movie really changed a lot of things. But you look at movies like, as great as that blockbuster was, what comes after? More of the same. We got to duplicate that to make money. Okay. So blockbusters, you look at, okay, the first Jurassic Park movie, and then look at Avengers. Okay. And how big of a spectacle Avengers is. The worlds that CGI... You know, I don't want to point out Avengers specifically, but it's a huge spectacle in the world that CGI can build for us, and how much bigger, faster, flashier, more colorful, more explosions, louder sound blockbusters are now compared to what they were before. So my long-awaited point is
there's a point.
Blockbusters are just like gateway drugs to the next blockbuster. How much bigger and better can you make the drug? Because we're going to get tired of it, because the way that I thought about this is I remembered somebody telling me about Colorado, where they've legalized marijuana. And so the thing in Colorado now is, okay, so it's like, okay, everybody's gonna, you know, you think it might be just kind of become a common thing, but what's happening, instead of like somebody here is like, yeah, we're gonna have a party, we're gonna have a get together, somebody's got some great weed. I mean, it's illegal, so it's like a big, oh my gosh, we're gonna have some good weed. That's cool. There it's like everybody, instead of, you know, drinking beers and then let's go smoke some marijuana, it's everybody smoking marijuana. We're gonna go over to my buddy's house, he's got this wicked great acid that we're gonna go drop. And so that's like legit happening out there. So we're just gateway drugging ourselves to the next thing. That's how we are as humans. We just, what's the next thing? This has satisfied me to a certain extent, but I want more, and now I want better. And so that's what's happening with movies. And so I think that's the kind of the nuance behind the point that they're trying to make in the movie, is that, like, we're not just going to be looking at our phones when there's a dinosaur on the screen, or, you know, it, like, literally right in front of us. We're going to be wondering what the next drug is.
Yeah.
And so they don't really dig that far into that in the movie. But
Yeah. I was thinking about the whole consumeristic aspect, like not being wowed by these spectacular things. And I guess I never thought of it before, but it really is about greed. You know, it's really about having like an insatiable need for something and trying to fill it with things that, you know, are not lasting.
Yeah.
And I don't know why I never associated the word greed with that. But if you look at this film and you look at the park, You know, they have to keep going so that they can, they have to keep building things so that they can keep going. Mm-hmm. And I just like envision this tidal wave, just like water gathering, and it just keeps getting higher and higher, and it's going to crash. It can't go, it can't keep going higher forever. And the more that we allow that to happen, instead of like checking ourselves, mm-hmm. you know, like a little bit at a time, mm-hmm. The more catastrophic the fall is going to be.
Well, I think that's a good point too, because we've already talked about how part of the issue was that, like, how can you not make money having a park on an island that you have to take an awesome helicopter ride to, you know, et cetera, et cetera. This sounds amazing, right?
Yeah.
Well, there's a conversation right at the beginning where, I can't remember what her name is.
Claire.
Mm-hmm. I keep wanting to call her Bryce because it's her real name.
Ron Howard's daughter.
Ron Howard's daughter. So Claire is making this point when she's talking to the owner guy, and he's like, yeah, we don't have to make tons of money. This isn't about making tons of money. He's like, we're fine. You know, I think they found some kind of balance. Like, we make dinosaurs, people come see it, everyone gets paid, thumbs up, right? But she goes, well, tell that to the shareholders who basically every, you know, there's people who are not invested in Jurassic Park for the wonder, for the amazement. They're invested in it because they want to make money. There's that greed. Not that just wanting to make money in and of itself is greedy, but pushing it to a level that causes you to do something maybe immoral or out of line with how things should be.
Mm-hmm.
And in this particular case, you know, trying to dictate or dominate nature, which was never what we were intended to do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, steward over nature, steward over creation, yes, but dictate and dominate it, like that was never really, you know, we get into lots of other conversations about that too, but so you see how that greed, we look for anything to kind of fill that greed.
I, you know, actually something, so there are some things in this film that are really well done. And I think, that scene with the T-Rex was very well done, because it's like, the scene where the T-Rex is eating a goat, which is like from the first movie, but people are disinterested. Yeah. And in the first movie, it's
Well, not only are they disinterested, the screen just hides it behind people who, the little kids that are looking on, but the older kid who's like been there, done that.
Right.
You know, I'm more interested in what's on my phone right now.
Yeah.
And that drives that point home visually very well.
Yeah. And so one thing that I thought was super well done that I didn't even really like fully grasp until I was like processing is the fact that the old park, all the old merchandise and everything, it's on the island. And instead of choosing to take the equipment there and refit it or rebuild or remodel, they hid it. It's now overgrown. It looks like they didn't touch it after, you know, the events of the first film. And they just built somewhere else.
Yeah.
And that, to me, really communicated this perception that I think is very true to human nature, which is that we're going to keep evolving, and we're just going to get wiser, and we, you know, we're just going to get smarter, and we won't make the same mistake again.
Mm-hmm.
And so we just kind of forget like what we did before, because we say that's not going to be us. We're going to be better than that.
Mm-hmm.
But the problem is, and then I started kind of equating with like the, I don't know, just thinking about us in relation to the dinosaurs, like the thing the dinosaurs have going for them is that they just are what they are. They just live in the whatever instincts they have naturally.
Right. Yeah, out of their identity.
Right. But we can't evolve because we are denying the instinct that we keep returning to, which is that I have a need for something bigger that I can't fill myself.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the evolution that needs to happen is a spiritual one, but as long as we're kind of denying that thing that's at our core, we're going to keep repeating the same mistake and pretending like, you know, it didn't happen. I mean, at the end of the movie, it's framed the same way the first movie was, you know, with the T-Rex roaring and everyone off the island.
And the idea that we are smarter than our previous ancestors shows that we're not smarter than our previous, us thinking that, you know, I heard one time Bill Maher, and I respect Bill Maher and you know, love his commentary on a lot of things. Even though I disagree a lot with what he says, but he's very well thought and very well put. But one thing I really disagreed with one time was when he was talking about, you know, this is the 21st century. Are we stupid enough to still need religion? You know, and it's like just that haughtiness of thinking that we are better than,
because
what, I have a touch phone, like I, you know, I can touch an app and play, you know, Angry Birds on my phone, like that makes me not need something better than myself, you know. And I think a lot of people inherently think that if they really, I think, dug into it, they would see, you know, a little bit more about themselves. But a lot of people, I think that we are the epitome of our species.
Oh yeah.
Well, and maybe in some ways we are. We've bettered ourselves in a lot of ways, sure. But you know,
at what price, Mark?
Well, that's the thing. I mean, the trappings are different, but they're, I don't know, the soul is still the same.
The soul,
it hasn't evolved.
You know, and even if you don't believe in a soul, I mean, just look at anything in our culture and cultures around the world. There are shades of all of history and everything that we do. So, you know, it's a very big thing to say that we are better than, you know, than the past and in a lot of ways. And to think that we're better, you know, to a point that we've evolved, that we don't need things that we once needed and stuff like that. I don't know.
But, I mean, I feel like I can hardly blame people, because when you're told from the time you're born, at least in this country, especially in this country, that if you want anything, it's yours, you just have to go get it. You just have to work harder and want it bad enough. And it's hard to imagine being told that most of your life, even if you're getting conflicting messages occasionally, if that's the prevailing thought of the majority of your culture, how you cannot have a self-centric view of the basically like your known universe. Like, how can you not believe that, okay, if I do work hard enough, I will get everything that I want, you know, regardless of my birth or culture or circumstance or skin color or gender, anything. Like, that's, I feel like that's a pretty big lie.
Right.
And when that lie is accepted by people who, if they really traced it, would not agree with it, theologically, and even socially to some degree, it gets mixed in, and we're going to see a lot of it. We're going to see a lot of people who are always looking for the next big thing. And that's what I was, you know, that's what I was kind of getting at earlier with, like, the, we see something and it impresses us, but then we want something more impressive.
Right.
But we've seen it. You know, I remember, it's like going back now and watching movies from my childhood, either with Laura or like some, you know, hang out with a bunch of people who are, you know, 10 years younger.
Right.
And seeing movies that I saw for the first time, and they're like, well, that wasn't that impressive. Well, I was like, well, yeah, CGI is coming a long way, but look at what they did when they didn't have any of that. I remember watching The Usual Suspects with a friend, and the ending of The Usual Suspects at the time was a pretty interesting twist.
Yeah.
But then after The Usual Suspects came out, not to ruin The Usual Suspects, because I'm guessing there's still lots of people who hadn't seen it for whatever reason. That kind of twist was used and then doubled down on and then tripled down on. And, you know, and then so like in a movie, it's you'll have like twist, 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 twist.
It's the gateway movie. I mean, like there's, I mean, seriously, like, you know, you got gateway blockbusters and you've got gateway movie tricks, and it's like, what that means is, and it's like, look at Die Hard. Action movies were forever changed because of Die Hard, because for the, you know, 15, maybe even 20 years after Die Hard came out, it was like, How do you pitch a movie? How do you pitch an action movie? It's Die Hard on a blank.
Yeah.
It's Die Hard on a plane. It's Die Hard on a train. It's Die Hard in the ocean. It's Die Hard in space, you know.
It's Die Hard here. It's Die Hard there. It's Die Hard everywhere.
It's
I will not eat
I will not eat Die Hard. Green Eggs and Ham, some reference. Anyway, you know, but then it becomes this, and it's because, you know, it makes a lot of money. People are interested. They want more. They want better. And then it evolves. And it's not, you know, all of this is not to say that, you know, progress is a great thing. It's not to say progress is bad. Progress is a great thing. So, you know, there's good and bad to it, but it becomes like, what do you make your ultimate? What do you lean against?
Yeah, kind of one of the motivations behind it.
Because, you know, we have that, you know, what you're saying, the lie of like, you know, I can go achieve and get everything I ever wanted. There's no such thing because... Once you have all that, you're going to want something else.
Right.
You're going to go get that.
Yeah, there's always going to be something.
What's the, God, what's the line from movie I can't think of, but it's like he asks someone from a movie that's about rich people. He says, how much money is enough?
It's Wall Street.
Yeah, I think it's one. Yeah. I'm going to look it up why that. But the answer to the question
about Gordon Gekko's greed speech?
It's not the Wolf of Wall Street. The one.
That Wall Street.
Just Wall Street, yes.
Yes, Wall Street with Michael Douglas. And yes. He's Gordon Gekko. And oh, greed is good.
Yes.
That speech that you're talking about?
Yeah. And so he's like, he asks him, how much money do you want? And he's like, just a little bit more.
I think that's his. It's been so long since I've seen that movie.
That's one of the great. That to me is the epitome of greed, mm-hmm. and I think one of the most honest answers about how much money people want, because people are always like, if I just win the lottery, mm-hmm. that's all I want.
Yeah,
you know, I'll be fine forever. Mm-hmm. If I just got that new job, then I'd make enough and I'd be fine forever. Mm-hmm. But yeah, but then you're gonna want that. Then you want just a little bit more, mm-hmm. and just a little bit more.
You know what I think is interesting too is that. It's easy to think that we're like in the driver's seat of that impulse, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, even with other things that we pretty much with anything in our world, money, sex, power, you know, we think like we're in control of this urge or this need or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But I feel like there's something much deeper going on, something spiritual going on. I think, and anyway, I'm thinking about that in terms of like these people and the dinosaurs thinking that, oh, we've got this, you know, it's like playing with fire and you think, like it's controlled, like I'm controlling this fire, but mm-hmm. You never really have control over it. I mean, something could happen in a snap and get out of your control. That. So yeah, I started thinking about that too, that we... These are, I don't know if you want to, I don't even really know what I think necessarily about, to the extent that I believe about, like, oppressive spiritual, negative spiritual principalities or whatever. But, I mean, I just feel like there are dark forces behind some of these things that are trying to get our focus off of, like, what has eternal value, you mm-hmm. know?
Right.
And we think that we're in control of them. And they let us think for a little while. So that we'll keep playing the game, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I want to make a point to that, but I want to clarify, because I use the internet again.
Rewind.
I feel like I should have known this.
And that's why you're a better species than your ancestors.
That's right.
Because we have the Googles.
So apparently it was John D. Rockefeller.
Okay.
I should have known this as a history major. The ultra-wealthy oil tycoon was asked exactly how much money would be enough. His answer was the oft-quoted maxim, just a little bit more. And this from the richest man in American history.
Yeah.
Mm.
Literally in American history.
Yeah, mm-hmm. So I'm pretty sure they used that for...
Lots of things.
But, so when we talk about, you know, never being really satisfied, that's kind of the question I was hitting on earlier, and why I think we're dancing all around, because I was just curious if... Like, are we completely anesthetized to violence and sex and shock in film these days? I mean, I feel like all it really takes is watching the latest episode of Game of Thrones, which we've covered on this show, and it's just gotten, I would say, exponentially more more violent, more sex-infused, more shocking, ever since we covered it. And I think that's just one example, not to single out Game of Thrones as like some kind of flagship for
terror. But it's kind of the cultural flag right now for you know, pushing the envelope. So, but I mean, I think, you know, I think Jurassic World and the Jurassic Park movies, you know, back to dinosaurs, you know, we all these friends who are, wait, dinosaurs. But, you know, you're talking about like these forces, you know, these dark forces that, you know, we in our theological worldview categorize them as one thing. But I think, you know, Jurassic Park movies, you know, kind of categorize that as like being outside of nature. Nature's rules go. That's what works. Nature's rules are one thing, and when you try to step outside that, you're kind of your own dark force of creating, you know, the things that are drawing you are still the kind of like the greed and want and more, but like once you start breaking nature's rules, you know, I think that there's some very, you know, naturalistic, humanistic kind of view here in the Jurassic Park movies that. So I think what you're saying is true. How we see it, you know, is one way. And I think Jurassic Park supports that as a kind of view,
but with a different vocabulary.
Yeah, just different vocabulary, and they don't, and obviously not stated like that, but implied.
I think this is another great point that I can't remember if JR explicitly says or heavily alludes to one or the other in his review, but he basically talks about greed and then goes on to make the point, or like I said, allude to the point that humanity's greatest threat is humanity. We're our own worst enemy, you know, because even though in Jurassic Park, Jurassic World, The Lost World, all these movies, we're always running from dinosaurs. We created the problem. You know,
well, and even specifically in this movie, they address the fact that these are not even really true dinosaurs as they existed. There's this big kind of like scientific kerfuffle about the movie, and of course scientists are going to have something to say about these kinds of movies, as well they should, but they're like, well, they've never done dinosaurs with feathers because dinosaurs originally had feathers. It's like, do they have feathers? Really? Whatever. So scientifically maybe they actually did have feathers, but like there's the whole conversation between the billionaire you know, money guy and the genetics guy, who, you know, remember him from the first one. He's the smart guy behind it now.
B.D. Wong.
B.D. Wong, that's right.
Dr. Henry Wu.
Is that his character's name?
That's his character's name.
He's a good actor. Anyway, he has the whole speech of, like, these aren't dinosaurs.
Right.
This is not what you wanted. Like, everything that we do is an amalgamation of...
Oh, when he's talking about, like,
trying to connect DNA strands. So, like, he's talking about the Indominus Rex being this, like, you know...
It's not a monster.
He's not necessarily that. It is a monster, but he's saying, you know, the billionaire's like, what have you done? How, you know, you're playing with all of these DNA structures, and you've created this thing, and he's like, that's how all these dinosaurs are. We're just, you know, scientifically, we're making stuff up as we go along, trying to connect DNA strands using DNA strands from other types of creatures in nature and trying to connect them. So he's basically saying that all these dinosaurs are not actually how they used to appear. So these movies even say that, like they even support that theory directly, because to say that we are creating these things, we are, this is our creation, you know, their creation in the movie, but like man's creation in the movie through just manipulation of DNA. Now they somehow harvested and made it mostly a dinosaur, but it's still a hybrid dinosaur. And it's not, you know, you inherently there, you still can't mess with nature is what they're saying, because you didn't actually create a dinosaur. You created a hybrid thing that from DNA strands that turned into a dinosaur. So, it's this movie, we're talking about all these things. This movie doesn't exactly do all these things very well. It's just all this stuff that's kind of inherent behind it.
Well, yeah, I mean, just because it's a Jurassic movie,
right?
Basically, yeah. Actually, the Christianity Today article, I just was like laughing the whole time I read it, because they were pulling in that concept about like being God and all the problems that come with that, and they kept quoting Malcolm. Like, he didn't quote anybody from this movie saying anything of substance about that.
Yeah.
He just was quoting
from the first movie.
Yeah, he just kept quoting from the first movie. And I was like, yeah, people really didn't verbalize any of that. It was just whatever was there in many ways existed because of the first movie.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, but maybe he's quoting from Malcolm's book, which was in the movie.
It was?
Yeah.
It was in Jurassic World?
Mm-hmm. There's like, he's got a book and it makes like two appearances. And
that's one of those.
Oh, I totally missed that. Yeah, Easter egg. I totally missed that.
Well, okay, so that's part of the thing about talking about Jurassic World that I have been trying to explain to people. And that is, while the movie's not exceptional, I mean, it is entertaining, but yeah, let's take that and kind of shove it into a closet to the side. It is entertaining. It brings up lots of topics, and while it doesn't, as a movie, actually talking about lots of them to any degree where you could claim that it's a recurring theme or a theme that like runs the length of the movie,
mm-hmm.
it does, one, connect to the other Jurassic Park movies. So, like, that stuff is kind of already in play.
Mm-hmm.
Also, the things that it does talk about that we've already kind of mentioned, even though Jurassic World doesn't talk about him a lot, it just kind of throws these little pitches out there, even though it doesn't hold them together with plot, right. that after the movie...
Or character.
Yeah, or character development, that you can kind of have conversations about. I mean, we're obviously having conversations about right now, right. even though the movie does a very poor job.
Yeah.
Right.
So, but I don't know if I would attribute this conversation really to Jurassic World.
Well,
much.
I mean, but that's the thing. 22 years later, we weren't having conversations about Jurassic Park, you know, last
mm-hmm.
week. Well, occasionally we want to see it, but like we weren't.
It.
So it's like I said, it's starting the conversation to have some of these other conversations.
Well, and it's an interesting, because we're talking about these movies now as a whole, kind of looking at it. It's interesting to look at it from the perspective of movies, because they, you know, arguably, you know, we heard from some of the commentary and the interviews and everything that maybe they were trying to make a commentary on how to make movies.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So with all of, I mean, you know, we got that funny meme out there that's like, wait a minute, Jurassic Park, Mad Max, Star Wars, what year is it?
Yeah.
You know, as we're kind of like gateway drugging to new heights with blockbusters, we still have all this nostalgia and all these mm-hmm. movies mm-hmm. either being remade or the story continued, the universe expanded and all this stuff. So, you know, is it okay? Because, I mean, like, Indiana Jones and the Crystal Skull, Kingdom of the Crystal Skull, is a horrendous movie.
It doesn't exist.
Okay? It doesn't exist.
Doesn't exist.
So, you don't even know what movie I'm talking about. I just made something up.
I thought you were talking about maybe the...
Frankie just blacked out for a moment.
Yeah, I did. What happened?
We just edited that. That was a splice to get... Mikey blacked out for a good 30 seconds. We had to stop and see if he was okay.
I got excited. I thought we were talking about like maybe the Young Indiana Jones Chronicles.
Yeah, right.
You know, something that adds depth and character and love and joy, adventure.
Stop.
So is all this? I mean, all this nostalgia is great, and it's very kind of a metaphor of how we, you know, move on as people. You know,
or don't
with
move
the
on.
Memory. Well, or don't move on or stay mm-hmm. stagnant. But with the memories of it, at least the good movies give us a good roadmap of like, you know, remembering your family, you know, your grandmother or something, you know, memories that have changed you, and then so you can mold it into a new movie.
Mm-hmm.
But is this okay? Is this an okay trend for movies to be in? Is this good for movies in general? Just thinking of it in terms of like these, you got to get bigger and badder and faster and more colorful. Is this good? I mean, is it okay? Is it enough to just be nostalgic and say, I created a movie in the Jurassic Park world, no pun intended, or, you know, do we need to go to something new? Do we need to stretch? Do we need to do both? I mean, you know.
So that's what's interesting to me when you bring that up is you've already talked about how people don't learn from their mistakes.
Right.
And we're not learning from our past because I can almost guarantee that even though I will probably thoroughly enjoy the new Star Wars movie, I'm never going to be like, oh, it's better than Empire.
Mm-hmm.
At some point, we look back to things that were less flashy, comparatively, even if the original was flashy. Less flashy, you know, had more depth, probably was slower paced, especially comparatively to what we make now.
Probably at least half an hour shorter.
Probably half an hour shorter. And we say, well, I was entertained, but it can't hold a candle to the original. Mm-hmm. And I feel like we don't learn from history when we bring these ideas back up. And I think that's why everyone was, like, just floored by Mad Max a month or so ago. Because not only do they bring back a concept, but they actually took it deeper than it's ever been taken. Mm-hmm. Now, sure, there were some great action set pieces. There was lots of, you know, fun things to watch visually. But they took it deeper. And I feel like that was one of the problems with Avengers. You could almost see Avengers 2 this year, that you could almost see the producers and Joss Whedon fighting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
After Joss Whedon said, the thing you do is go deeper, not go bigger.
Yeah.
And you could tell where he was trying to go deeper, and there was obviously a lot of pressure to have these huge set pieces, these long, extended fight scenes.
Yeah.
Well, the thing about Mad Max is that it was actually, like, a really great balance between, like, new ideas, like, where our culture is right now with certain things, but also, like, what worked from filmmaking from before. So it was actually appreciating, like, tools and strategies from the past that made the thing great. Mm-hmm. And he brought both those together, which tends not to happen in films now, because we're like, well, we can just CGI it, so why wouldn't we, you know?
Well, it's like, you know, it's kind of, think about it, do it right, you know, but it's not just enough to be nostalgic, it's not just enough to make a movie out of, you know, an old franchise, or an old TV show, or something, you know, it has to be done well, and it has to have meaning and stuff, but it's like, the idea of, like, seeing it for the first time, like, you know, nothing was going to be as good as Avengers the first time that you saw Avengers, because Avengers was just, like, so well done, but it was also, like, this actually worked, and the spectacle is amazing, and it all fits and everything. Even if the second movie was done as well, it's kind of like that whole thing of, like, even if JJ makes on par with Empire, arguably a better movie than Empire, which is blasphemous, I get it. Whatever, you know, you can roast me for that one, but, you know, just in theory, you know, it's not going to be the same experience, right, for me, or for you, but what about the little kid in the theater that's never seen a Star Wars movie?
Well,
or never seen a Star Wars movie in the theater?
Well, that's the next generation, that's the same argument, that the 20 years are younger.
Right.
It is like, oh, I thought episode one was pretty good, and you hit them, and you're like, stop it.
Stop being ignorant.
Stop being ignorant. because they had a different experience. They didn't realize they were like it could be so much better.
Right.
Which is why, you know, and I think we've talked about this on one of the episodes, and I know Laura's talked about it on another podcast about, like, we want to share those experiences with children, and we want to do it in a way that preserves some of that nostalgia and doesn't jump right into the newest first.
Right.
So you don't, you know, but how do you do that? And you know, you want to preserve that nostalgia.
Right.
And I hear that too.
So it's like we're a culture that values nostalgia too.
But we forget that we value nostalgia.
We forget that And we want more and bigger and better. We don't want what we had, but we want to remember what we had while looking forward to something bigger. Because, I mean, it's like, you know, how many different times has Batman been done? How many times, you know, how many more Spider-Man remakes were there?
A lot.
A lot, unfortunately. Until people stop paying, you know. So.
But I don't really see it as, like, is this a good or bad trend, but that it is a trend. Like, it's something that we cannot stop doing, is just revisiting the things that made us feel something. We want to feel that again, you know? And we want to feel it over and over and over again. Mm-hmm. But yeah, there's something about... But you can't recreate it. You can never have that exact same experience again. So
but you can have
we
a
try
new
to
experience.
Get it a different way.
Yeah, but you can have
work.
But you can have a new experience, right? You can have a new experience that's on par with that feeling that you got the first time, but it might not come from, like, this, you know, how do you revisit something and not get that feeling, but try something that's new, like a new franchise that comes out. You know, I'm not trying to make this sound like a drug.
Like, you could maybe have that same, get that same value, but it doesn't have to be from the same thing. Like, we could look bigger, Right. Yeah. So you're saying we can like do a new thing.
You know, it's like, for me, like, I get really blasé about, you know, movies or something, and then I see something really just, you know, that blows my mind, and I'm really like, I'm glad I go to movies, you know, still, mm-hmm. and, mm-hmm. you know, like, Mad Max was one of the, you know, kind of, sort of that thing that kind of, you know, kicked the butt of the movie world for this year, mm-hmm. of like, you know, you can do better. You know, just seeing that amazing, you know, I keep bringing this up, it's just the example I have, Avengers. When I saw Avengers, I was like, I cannot believe I just saw that,
mm-hmm.
you know, because it was just a whole mess of new stuff that you didn't expect that could work and work so well and mm-hmm. be that yeah. much fun. So, you know.
Yeah, and I guess that's the thing, is that it's an act of trust to take a step out like that and say, no one's ever really tried this before, and it could totally flop.
Right.
But we're going to try it anyway because it could be really good, mm-hmm. you know? And those are the things that actually bring us the satisfaction that we're looking from other places. But, I mean, there's such a culture now of, to some degree, you have to get your movie seen. You have to make back whatever you put into it. And how do you do that? When you're feeding a culture that is really distrustful, you know, they're mm-hmm. like scared to move out because what if it doesn't make them feel the way they want? You right. know what I'm saying?
And it really is indicative of how life works, you know, like mm-hmm. you can't, you know, nothing's meant to last, and everything starts to fade and go away. And it works like that for movies and nostalgia. Mm-hmm. Like when I was walking into the theater to see Jurassic World, I saw a poster for the 40th anniversary showing of Jaws.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, Spielberg 40 years ago made Jaws, which was a groundbreaking film at the time, scared the crap out of people. Now you look at it and the shark looks fake,
mm-hmm.
you know, and, you know, then he made Jurassic Park 20 years ago, and now Jurassic World, the legacy of that is still going. So it's like, all of this is like connected somehow, but it's not the same.
Right.
And you can't ever get that back. That's just how... That's how life works. Yeah. But you can look back on it with that feeling of like when those kids walked into the old, you know, main hub from the first movie, and they started seeing like the sign that fell at the end mm-hmm. of the movie, and you're like, dang, that's cool. You kind of expected it going into the movie, but like, and maybe it's a little heavy handed, but it was cool.
Yeah.
You know, because like he picked up the goggles that Tim had mm-hmm. in the truck with the mm-hmm. night vision on it, and I was like, that's, you know, the little things like the walkie talkies they used were still there and right. stuff like that. So,
well, I thought that was great because yeah.
I loved it. I loved the heck out of that. That was one of my favorite parts of the movie
because it's just for the viewer, oh, yeah. you know, because totally. Otherwise no yeah. one gets it. Yeah.
So that makes me want to take like a theological leap.
Okay.
That might be unwarranted, but I'm going to do it anyway. You know why?
It's your show. Go ahead.
So when we talk about like nostalgia, I don't just think about nostalgia. I think about how people look to the idea, and we've kind of hit on this already, that one day we're going to attain this level of knowledge, this level of enlightenment, mm-hmm. this level of being, where we'll finally move past, like you talk about Bill Maher, like, do we really need religion? Like, haven't we evolved past that?
What's that Star Trek world? You know, we've evolved past poverty.
Yeah, like, we evolved past things that...
Mm-hmm. You know, the need for monetary gain.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I noticed that, you know, we do have a tendency as a people or as humanity, to go in that direction. Like, when I learn something new, I often stop and remind myself that now that this is new, there's nothing good in the past. We've moved past the past.
Mm-hmm.
But that's the thing with having a belief system that's based on truths. Not relative truths, but absolute truths.
Mm-hmm.
And one of my favorite things is when you get to a certain point in theology, or with Christianity specifically, and you're not exactly sure where to go next. I feel like one of the beauties of it is that you can look back. And they haven't, you know, Christians as a whole have not done everything right throughout history, not even close. But there are certain truths that you can look back to about how people are trained, how people are taught, how you treat people. I mean, we basically have a book that's very, very old that we have not updated, you know, in 1900 years, because there it is full of truth. And I feel like people keep wanting to move past that. Like, well, that was something we needed for a time. That was something we needed a little while. But we realize the more and more we get the new stuff, the less and less it holds the weight of what we want. And we have to go, man, I sure miss when I had this thing that had depth and some kind of solidity to it that I know I can rest on.
Kind of speaks to the, there's kind of a resurgence of people, especially younger people, coming back to the liturgical tradition.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, I don't, I mean, I think, you know, we believe this theologically, but I believe it based on experience as well, is that human nature never changes. Human nature is always the same. We're still, even though we've got, you know, Jaws 40 years ago and all that, you know, Jurassic Park 20 years ago, we got Jurassic World now, all these spectacle movies now compared to, like, you know, the bad CGI from when we were kids and all that stuff, we're still telling the exact same stories.
Right.
It's all the same story.
And it's still relevant. That's why, and this film, still relevant. Even though they didn't say a lot of those thematic things, we felt it. We knew exactly what the problem was.
Yeah. Well, and even Jurassic Park had the same, like, the entire idea of John Hammond creating the park was that we wanted something bigger, something real. He, you know, he made that, like, you know, impassioned speech about having the flea circus when he was a kid. That, you know, this is from the first film. Never, you know, or if you don't remember, whatever. But I'm trying to set it up without, you know, going too much and setting it up, but. You know, John Hammond created the park, and he was talking about how he just loved seeing the faces of the kids, seeing the fleas, oh, you know, and they would walk up and they'd do a little, you know, jumping off the diving board into the pool, and then, you know, the thing would splash, and he was like, but it was all animatronic, it was all based on, you know, just, the fleas weren't actually there, but their imagination put the fleas there, and it made this, like, very cool, you know, scene, and I enjoyed that, but I thought, what if they actually saw it? What if the fleas were actually there doing those things? So I created these dinosaurs, you know, to have this, to give that experience. Because why? We need bigger. We need the actual thing. We need better. We need dangerous. We need the big T-Rex snarling with his big teeth and eating the goat. And, you know, we want those things. So the original movie made that exact same point that this movie is making. It's just this movie's cultural reference is, you know, your cell phone and how you're interested in all the distractions.
Just updated.
So we're telling the same stories.
Yeah.
Well, with that said, let's start to wrap it up.
Okay.
We obviously didn't think this was perfect.
So, right.
Laura, what really annoyed you about this movie?
I want to say that just the flat characters in general, the boys specifically, anytime they were on screen, I think I found myself even physically grimacing sometimes. Just because I knew what I was supposed to feel about them and their relationship and their thing with the parents, but only because they were, like, saying it out loud. Didn't what matter. I should be feeling.
Yeah. None of it mattered.
Yeah,
and
mattered.
So it annoyed me even more because it was like, I know what you want me to feel, and it wouldn't really be that hard to make me feel that, but I don't feel it at all.
Yep.
So the boys really annoyed me, but thinking about how, like, two-dimensional these characters are made me realize how incredible the character development is from the first one. And just
We can't compare the two movies.
Yeah.
They're not.
I mean, we've been doing that for like an hour, but we can't.
Not really, not in the terms of, like, how well they were done.
It's true. But I mean, like, I had a lot of fun thinking about that because I hadn't really, I don't think I'd realized how much each person shifts or changes or how they've got such a deep character. Like, you've got this millionaire who is not a typical millionaire. He actually is a very caring, thoughtful person who wants to give to children, you know? You have, like, the chaotician or whatever who is just silly, but he ends up being right about everything, you know? I mean, it just made me realize how much I love those characters and, you know, coincident, like, not coincidentally, but consequently made me hate these characters even more.
Just hate them.
So, but yeah, specifically the boys. And also, it really annoyed me how brutally they had to kill, like, that babysitter. That was, like, the most brutal, gruesome death in the whole... They had her, like, drowning and then being tossed around and then being eaten.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
It just bothered me. Yeah. Because she was supposed to be despicable, and we're like, okay, so only the bad people get brutally.
That's what dinosaurs are.
Are you wearing a trucker hat? Anyway, this would be my biggest.
Yeah, but we didn't even get enough problems. Of her to think, oh, she's despicable. I mean, she just was. I don't know.
Well, I knew that she was despicable because of the things they made her say.
Well, that's true. Yeah.
Anyway.
That's what they wanted you to think.
But the dinosaurs told us who was good and bad for the most part.
Because they ate all the bad people.
They ate the bad people.
Are we doing the come on, man, or just what annoyed you? Which is kind
of same thing.
Same thing. Yeah. All right. Mine is high heels.
I knew that was going to come up.
High heels. Nothing wrong with high heels. All right, that's fine. Whatever. But in an action movie, when you have this stereotypical kind of one-sided, one-dimensional female figure, she's running around the forest in what? In high heels. It's such a movie Hollywood, like, oversight that happens so often. It's not even really a cliche, because it's almost like they don't really do it on purpose. But I really hate the fact that she was running around in high heels. I think it's the stupidest thing.
It is so dumb.
It's one of the stupidest things.
They, like, committed to that 100%.
They did.
Because they actually had her, like, Bryce Howard wearing her the whole time. And I don't know why. Why was that so important?
They had shots that, like, highlighted her high heels, and it's like, that's poor filmmaking because they think that is visually saying something about her character, and we're all just going, come on, man. That's ridiculous. And there's a lot of, I mean, there are enormous plot holes in this movie. There's so many, I don't even think I can count them. Like, I can't even remember them all at once. I keep thinking about this movie, you know, all the way through, like, the week and stuff, like, after I've seen it, and I keep remembering, oh my god, wait. So how did that thing connect to that thing? Oh, that's a plot hole.
That's another connection. Plot hole.
So anyway, and you know, it's a sloppy movie, it's a messy movie, but I still really enjoyed the heck out of it. I mean, I was really entertained. It was a blast. So they did all the dinosaur things really well. Mm-hmm. Well, I'm sure. We'll get to the good stuff
right
in a second. Structure. Yes. Is the way we do things here.
Structured. Well, so I had this question that I was going to answer, but I figured it was going to get covered. And the whole concept of it was, you know, with the film focusing so much on the big, the flashy, et cetera, do the characters basically become inconsequential?
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like we've more or less already answered that.
Yeah.
And so I started making little notes to myself. So if I forgot, like, a character that I wanted to mention, and I was just like, Claire is the worst. Owen is the best. The children are pointless.
The pointless.
And my favorite was, I just typed out, the parents' divorce equals what?
Yeah.
So that, I mean, like I said, I realized, yeah, I talked about what JR said, you know, we're putting down money to be entertained, not because of plot, which is sad. Especially, you know, with the mission of, like, this podcast and what we would hope to have you think about.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, seriously,
and
like,
the mission of the movie.
Well, hypothetically.
Sort of. I mean, thematically, what they were reaching for, like, in the hands of somebody a little bit more seasoned as a director, maybe, or a writer.
You think it was a director? I mean, I felt like script. They're just like, hey, can we just slap a whole bunch of stuff together?
Yeah, well, which is surprising because the writing team that wrote this also wrote Dawn of the Planet of the Apes. So,
yeah. I keep mixing up all the reviews I read, but didn't JR post, like, a like a conversation that happened between...
Well, his hypothetical conversation.
Oh, it was hypothetical? Yes. Okay, I didn't get to that. You said, I totally believed 100% that that actually happened.
Because it does kind of seem like that would have happened, right?
Yes,
it does. That was the... that's why I said it's like the artist, his artist rendering of what he imagined a conversation between the writers and the producers was.
Which side, is probably... Side note, if you don't know what we're talking about, read the site where JR...
That's right. Again...
Yes, JR wrote a great review for Real World
Theology. But I don't... one thing with his hypothetical conversation was like they didn't intend to actually have the T-Rex fight the Indominus Rex. I think he was trying to... Yeah. I think that was always in my opinion, that was always gonna happen. Anyway.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, but probably maybe indifferent.
Yeah, sure.
Alright, favorite moment. Favorite stuff. What did you like about it?
I was pretty impressed how they made the T-Rex a hero. Especially from, I mean, watching him, like, from the first movie, watching the T-Rex eat the lawyer off the toilet is, like, one of my vivid childhood memories of, like, the scaredest I've ever been in my life. So, and just that whole scene in general is terrifying. So, for the T-Rex, and it wasn't that the T-Rex, that they neutered it, like, it wasn't that terrifying or scary, but just that it was, like, the hero. Mm-hmm. I really liked that for some reason.
Like in this movie?
Yeah, this movie,
Well, he's sort of the hero at the end of the first one, too, because he comes in and saves them from the raptors.
Oh, that's true.
And then he roars, and then that brilliant Steven Spielberg kind of, like, thing where, you know, the sign comes down and it says, when dinosaurs ruled the earth, and oh my god.
So, and they, like, run underneath him, like, so under his protective wing, or hers. Yeah, yeah, so I liked that. I liked that she went and got him, got mm-hmm. her. To help them.
Yeah. Well.
Minus the heels.
I think my favorite shot and my favorite moment from the whole scene is when that big door opens where uh-huh. the T-Rex is and she's holding that flare mm-hmm. and the first thing you see is his eyes and the flare is glaring off of his eyes and he comes out of the shadows. Mm-hmm. That was a really cool scene. That had a moment, a very, very, very quick moment of like that awe that the T-Rex... has, mm-hmm. you know, had from the first movie. You know, it's like they got, you know, kind of away from it in all the other movies. You know, the T-Rex, I don't even think, was T-Rex barely in the third one. It was a stupid idea to take him to the city, and that was kind of dumb in the second one. But, you know, with this one, they kind of sort of brought back that awe,
yeah.
you know, for a moment for me. And I really, really loved that moment. Like that scene of the okay, it's T-Rex time. Because you know, it's like, what dinosaur rules all other dinosaurs in anything? In Jurassic Park, for sure, but in culture in general, the T-Rex.
The king.
The king. He's the king of dinosaurs. Even though we make fun of him with the little arms. And, you know, I can't reach, you know, that kind of funny thing. But like, which dinosaur are we talking about? The T-Rex. Mm-hmm. You know, so whether we're making fun of it or like he's, you know, eating a... you know, lawyer off the toilet, he's the king of dinosaurs, so to bring him out like that was really cool. Mm-hmm. So, I really enjoyed that. I liked Chris Pratt. I thought Chris Pratt did as best as he could with the role he was given.
Considering... the script he was given. Considering he was pretty amazing.
I was disappointed they didn't let him be Chris Pratt more, you know, kind of jokey, and mm-hmm. he had that kind of moment with her at his, like, little compound area, whatever. But that was about it. But he did, you know, I followed him through the movie.
Yeah.
You know?
Mm-hmm. Well, so I feel like my favorite stuff is really similar. There were lots of things in this movie when they were pointing out how things aren't incredible or how people don't think things are incredible anymore mm-hmm. that reminded me that, like, I think dinosaurs are way cool.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember that one of the whole reasons I loved science as a kid was because of dinosaurs. I mm-hmm. loved watching, like, PBS shows about dinosaurs. Like, they were the best thing. I would watch them over and over and over mm-hmm. again.
Dinosaurs are kind of a quintessential part of, like, most childhoods, mm-hmm. you know?
So
since, like, the 30s and 40s, yeah. the dinosaur toys, you know? Like, I mean, it's hundred years, like, of toys and that kind of thing.
Yeah, Watch this, what's up?
Yeah, well, I say, yeah. So, or, like, apparently Nick knows what's up now.
The guy who had all the toys.
Whatever his character's name is.
Jake Johnson.
Yeah, Jake Johnson's character, which is still just Nick from New Girl.
Nick from New Girl, yeah.
he was probably my favorite part of this movie. Which is funny to me because I'm tired of his character in New Girl, so much so that I stopped watching the show. But it really worked in this movie. I needed his comic relief.
Yeah, it did.
I felt it was like the only comic relief in the whole movie that was actually written fairly well. Comparatively.
Yeah.
That's not to say that I did not thoroughly enjoy Chris Pratt's character.
Sure.
Because though he is the, you know, the cliche of cliches, I think he owned it. And he goes, yeah. See what they're doing here? I'm just going to have fun with it.
Yeah.
Right.
And when the kids told Claire that her boyfriend was awesome.
Yeah.
Clean podcast.
Yeah.
I was like, I let out a chuckle. I thought that was great.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, they had several of those that were really great.
Yeah.
Like, who's that? Yeah. And like, we want to stick with you.
Oh, no worry. I'm not leaving you. No, not you.
Well, yeah, not you. Him.
I think he, you know, Chris Pratt is not, you know, Chris Pratt's known for being Chris Pratt, you know, Andy from Parks and Rec, that kind of style, but he's actually a really good actor, and I think he actually, again, with what he was given, played against the type purposefully, like, made his character, like, kind of stay away from that hero type, because he's like, you can just take those raptors out, man, and just be a killing machine with these things, and he's like, no, why would I do that? That's stupid. So, his character is written that way, but he really played into the, like, I am not a stereotype, I'm a stereotype, but I'm not a stereotype, you know, like, manly cliche.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'll say this too, as for my last piece of like, and to try to get it in real quickly, I thought I was going to think the him and the raptor thing was completely stupid, but I totally was into it.
I know. I don't know how he did that. I don't.
Yeah.
Because it wasn't like they were like his best buddies. There was like conflict there. There was like tension.
Danger.
And it was one of the only things I felt like they really did well between the dinosaurs and
That whole scene of you know, the poster, the, you know, of him riding the motorcycle and everything. Mm-hmm. I mean, that, you know, if you think about it, it's really ridiculous.
Yeah.
But you know, like, I loved the cameras on the heads of the raptors and, like, how we got all those shots of, like, you know, that was as brilliant to me as, like, the raptors in the grass in the second movie, which is one, again, first half of that movie's pretty good. Like, when you have the raptors in the grass, that's incredibly scary.
Oh, yeah.
It was an inventive kind of way to, you know, kind of reinvent how scary they are. This one, it was just really cool, just kind of have that, you know, once they turned on everybody and, like, you know, like, dragging them away. I mean, that was the dinosaur stuff in this movie is the second best of the franchise. Because you can't beat the first one, but I mean, from all the other sequels, the dinosaur stuff in this one is far superior.
Hmm. Well, with that said, and agreed upon, I always like to thank people for taking the time to be on the show by giving them a chance to let other people know how they can find what they're up to. So, Laura, how can people follow what you do?
Probably right now, just reading anything I post on Real World Theology.
That's a great plan.
Which is only sometimes.
Super sound.
I know. But I have a Whoology article hopefully coming out this month.
Yay.
So,
hopefully.
Yeah.
Awesome.
Hopefully. Yeah, I'm working on it. I'm trying. I'm off my game right now. But on Twitter, I'm at @Laura_Fissel, and my website is laurafissel.com.
Sweet. Mark?
Twitter's Mark Wingdinger. And then I'm on Real World. And as I always say, I'm writing stuff behind the scenes. Cause I'm just a sad, tortured artist that's a writer. Yeah, you know, that kind of, not really. But I'm writing behind the scenes. So if you have Twitter, let's talk to, you know, comment on my articles. I'd like some discussion on that in Real World. So
sweet.
Yep.
Well, you can follow me at Fizzification. You can follow Real World Theology at Real World Theo, both on Twitter. If you'd like to know more about Real World Theology, visit our website, realworldtheology.com. That's R-E-E-L, worldtheology.com. And we fully admit that there's no way, even in all this time, that we've talked about everything that you could talk about from Jurassic Park, from the whole Jurassic series, from Jurassic World. So please continue the conversation with us on the website, on Facebook, connect with us there, subscribe to the podcast on iTunes or Stitcher, and I have not made this clear before, but I will start making this clear. You can look for new episodes on the 1st, 10th, and 20th of every month. We do three podcasts a month. So look for those, or the closest weekday to those days.
You're so organized.
Yeah. I know. Well, being on schedule, people prefer when you're on schedule. I like people to know that three times a month, on around more or less a certain day, you'll get a new episode of this podcast. We work very hard, lots of great guests, and lots of people giving up lots of their time to make sure that we're having really good discussions about movies. And so, like I said, that's why I like the guests. Follow them, have conversations with them. And if you enjoy what we do here, please review the show on iTunes. Like I said, continue to connect with us. So again, you know, thank you, Laura. Thank you, Mark. Mm-hmm. Thank you, listeners, for taking the time to make us a part of your week. And until next episode, which will be whatever the day is after, the show date is after, remember, the story is powerful and entertainment is not mindless. Bye-bye.
Mister.
Mister.
Mister to you.
They call me Mister.